All right, you ready? So, yes.
Yeah. I don't know why Forrest Gump just jumped into my head. I haven't seen that in forever, but there it was.
Wait, I think I can track that. I think because we were talking about Peter Jackson, which led you to Frighteners, which made you think about Bob Zemeckis, who produced it, which made you think about Forrest Gump.
That's really not that off from what may have actually happened.
All right.
This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Happy Halloween, junkies! Welcome to this particularly frightening episode of Junk Food Cinema. This is Film School Reject's weekly cult and exploitation film cast that traipses through the graveyards of filmdom, gleefully unearthing the lost and the underappreciated. I am your host, Brian Salisscary, and I am joined by my friend and co-host, novelist slash screenwriter, Zombie Cargill!
This is the last pun, right?
It is. See, I didn't even do a pun for yours because I knew you were getting so tired of it.
Oh,
I
thought
I
would just... Oh, my God, the puns.
I ran out of bullets. I ran out of bullets, so I just threw the pun at you. Hey-o! And with that, I will remind you that we are available on iTunes in case you want to go back and listen to hours and hours of that. It's on iTunes. It's also on Stitcher. You can follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. You can also like us on Facebook, facebook.com/, you guessed it, Junk Food Cinema. And every movie we talk about, we'll put up Amazon links here on the page. Sometimes for movies that you can't actually buy, because we go that deep. We are deep track nerds. But the ones that you can buy, there'll be an Amazon link. If you go to Amazon via that link, even if you don't buy that item, anything you buy from the link actually benefits us, so we really do appreciate it.
Thank you!
And we have reached the end of Schlocktober, somehow, without being slashed, stabbed, or possessed by demons. I don't know how we pulled it off.
Speak for yourself.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good to know.
That was most of Saturday.
It has been an interesting weekend, and this one coming up is Halloween weekend, so it promises to be just as weird. But we're going to wrap up our month-long discussion on the underrated horror of the 90s with a little film called Fallen.
Oh, hell yes.
Now, I must admit to this, Fallen is always one of those movies that I had on my must-see list, and for the longest time, just never got around to watching. And then, I want to say it was about a month ago, I actually sat down and watched it for the first time, and I found out that what everybody was saying about it being so great was true.
Yeah. No, I am on the opposite end of that spectrum. I saw it opening day. I was really excited to see it. And, I had gone to the movie theater and it was, you know, it was long ago and decided, well, if I'm going to go all the way out to the movie theater, I'm going to see a double feature. So I saw that and a little unknown movie called Half Baked.
A weird combination of films to watch.
And yet both of them amazing. And it was one of those, it's one of my favorite days of film of all time because I literally went out to see these two movies I had only seen trailers for and was like, fuck it, I'll give these a shot. And they turned out to be a comedy classic and this sadly underrated gem.
It's crazy because a lot of people will probably instantly hear this title and think, that's not a horror film. And there's such a weird, vague delineation between the thriller and the horror film that I'm not even sure typically where I would draw that line. But frankly, I think when you start talking about ancient demons and actual possession, you've at least, you know, forayed a little bit into the world of horror films.
I can't imagine anyone not saying this is a horror film. I can't imagine, you know, there are police procedural elements to it, but there are procedural elements to a lot of great horror films.
Like Silence of the Lambs, for example.
Well, but I was avoiding that because that's the one that's on the bubble.
That's a bubble film. Okay.
That's one of the films that causes the most, the most arguments is it a horror movie or is it a thriller? Mm-hmm. And, because if we call it a thriller, then we can group it in with Seven. But is Seven actually a horror movie, or is Seven a thriller? Because they're both dealing with very similar elements, and so that is that film that perfectly sits on the bubble. This is on the other fucking side of that bubble with fucking demon with fallen angels that are possessing people, and lots of bodies pile up.
Basic plot structure here is that you have a detective played by Denzel Washington, okay, who is, at the beginning of the film, presiding over the execution of a killer that he put away, and this killer on death row is acting very, very odd, and tells him, you know, things like, you know, I'll be looking for you, and he starts speaking in a dead language, and he starts singing the Rolling Stones, and it's like, doesn't really seem like he's in the mindset that his life is about to end. In fact, it seems like very much the opposite, like he's preparing for the beginning of something. And then afterwards, for several, you know, weeks afterwards, he starts getting these little tinges, like things that used to happen while the killer was alive, phone calls he used to get from the guy and things like that. And the song keeps coming up, and a lot of eerie situations keep unfolding. And then as he digs into it, it becomes clear that this killer has not died. Well, there was something living within this killer that has not died, but has instead found a new host and then can pass from host to host with as little as a single touch. So that's the basic plot of the film. Now, of course, you can't believe everything the film tells you. I don't know how else to put that. There's a twist in this film that I guess we'll have to talk about, so I guess it's not spoiling it to say that there is a twist. We will spoil what the twist is, and then at that point we'll officially be spoiling it. So, highly recommend you watch the movie before you listen to this discussion.
Yeah, now might be a good time to, if you're like, you know, I really would like to watch, I've never seen this, these guys are glowing about this, I trust these guys at this point.
Thank you for your confidence.
This would be the point to pause said podcast and watch it immediately. It's very easy to find. You can find it all over the place. And watch the hell out of this movie, and then come back and revel in our discussion, because this really is one of those really, really great underrated gems. And it's going to be one of those things that if you have not seen this, you are going to pat yourself on the back for having listened to a podcast that told you to see it so that you could see it and you'd be like, I fucking found this movie, man. This is great. it's one of those. It's one of those that you can't believe isn't part of the mainstream. Especially considering the cast.
Yeah, the cast is unbelievable. I mean, we mentioned Denzel, but Donald Sutherland is in it. John Goodman is in it.
John Goodman at the height of John Goodman-ness. Like, this is at the point when you put John Goodman in something and people flock to see it.
Right. And then, of course, James Gandolfini is in it.
Who nobody knew at the time.
Nobody knew at the time.
Elias Koteas.
Actually, one thing I find funny about the cast in this film is that James Gandolfini and Ida Turturro are both in this film, and they both work at the same precinct. So Tony Soprano and his sister both work at the same precinct, according to this movie.
Well, when you make movies in New York, you get all the same actors.
That's true.
That's just what it is.
That's true. And that might also explain why Elias Koteas is in this, who, as much as I love Denzel, steals this fucking movie.
Oh, yes.
It is the premier performance in the entire film.
The first time I watched it, I was like, holy shit, Casey Jones. That's awesome. and then from that moment on, he was no longer Casey Jones.
He was
the demon at the beginning of this movie.
Because for me especially, like, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, as silly as they were, that was such a huge part of my childhood. And that first movie, I absolutely fell in love with. I watched it all the time. So yeah, growing up, Elias Koteas, I just knew him as Casey Jones. And then, you know, I've seen him in a lot of movies since then, but I wish I had seen this directly after Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, because that would have fucked my little mind right the hell up.
Oh no, it's why he's one of the few character actors whose names I never forget.
Yeah.
The minute he shows up, I'm like, Elias Koteas, because he's fucking awesome. In this movie, he is given so much to play with, and that opening scene, he sets the tone for the whole movie.
Remember this, Hobbs? What goes around really goes around.
You have a safe trip, yeah?
You know, that's the thing about Denzel, is you get Denzel when you need the alpha fucking male.
Right.
And you need dependability. But the thing about Denzel is most of the time you get a very even keel performance. You get a guy who is mostly unflappable. Mm-hmm. He's not known for mugging for the camera and making wild expressions. Which is why when he does
Training Day,
when he did Training Day,
yeah,
and he gets
exactly
to the end, and he gives that huge, you know, King Kong
cases on all your ass,
King Kong ain't got nothing on me. Like, when that happens, it's like, holy shit, that's the can of whoop-ass that Denzel's been sitting on for years, and he just busted it out for the Oscar.
That's the can of whoop-ass he put in the fridge at Virtuosity.
Yes.
And just left there for several years and then pulled it out exactly when he needed it and won an Oscar.
We need to do an episode on Virtuosity.
I knew that that was going to happen if I mentioned Virtuosity, because, and I don't disagree with you.
We need to talk about that movie. But right now, we're talking about the after movie, the movie that came after Virtuosity.
There should be a drinking game for Junk Food Cinema. Every time we're in the middle of an episode about one film and we say we need to do an episode on a completely different film, take a drink, because that happens a lot.
That's a finish the drink. If you're not drinking while you're listening to us, you're doing this wrong. We're drinking, for fuck's sake.
Almost every single time. So, yes, Elias Koteas, though, in this movie, what I think is so amazing, his physicality as this killer is so specific and so subtly eerie, because he's not necessarily doing anything that, you know, is like otherworldly. He's not... There's nothing about his movements that seems supernatural. They're just a little bit off, and just like certain ways that he twists his face, and then like dancing all the way down death row, and then like some of the things he says, you know, like, ladies and gentlemen and pederasts, hope you enjoy the show.
He is so good in this movie that he's only in the first 5 minutes.
Exactly.
And we spent more time talking about him than any other actor in the movie.
That's very true. And that's definitely
because he never comes back. We never, you know, we see him on video again, but all we see on video is the scene we've already fucking seen. So there's nothing new.
Right.
And yet Elias Koteas fucking steals the goddamn show in this movie.
And it's funny too, because a production note on the movie, after this is the first scene that they shot. There was another scene that they were supposed to shoot. I'll get to that later. It didn't happen. So the first scene that they shot is with Elias Koteas in this prison that eventually was closed down. And the director was so impressed with his performance that he actually took the tape of Koteas performing as the killer at the beginning of the movie, and he showed it to all of the actors who would later be possessed by Azazel, because they wanted those actors to imitate that same physicality, which is why, as the movie goes on and you watch the spirit that was living within Elias Koteas' character move into other people, you see at least tinges of that same physicality. And I think that's so smart. I think it's great that it was almost an afterthought. It was like, oh, it wasn't until I saw this amazing performance that I even thought, oh, we need to make sure that every subsequent vessel imitates that same performance.
Yeah, he really nailed it and cemented himself as a horror actor for the next two decades.
Oh, absolutely.
Like he that's why he gets so many, you know, gigs doing, you know, just walk on, you know, small parts in horror movies, because he fucking brings that every fucking time.
Yeah. And in fact, when I met him, I was fortunate enough to meet him. It was he was at the Let Me In premiere at Fantastic Fest, because he's in that movie.
Nice.
So it's like very much like the reason I met him wasn't because of some weird Ninja Turtle screening or anything like that. It was because of another horror role for him. Yeah. So yeah, absolutely. This led to him getting more roles, and it's because of his dedication, I think. Like, for example, Edgar Reese is the name of the killer. He, at the beginning of the film, speaks to Denzel Washington in Syrian Aramaic, which is not a language they teach at most public schools. And
it's not a spoken language.
No.
Not anymore.
He actually fucking learned those lines, because they later in the movie, they translate what he was saying. So they retcon that. He actually learned the Syrian Aramaic translation for his lines that he, you know, he's speaking. He learned it from two separate scholars. The first guy lived in Ohio and taught him everything, but was so devoutly religious that he wouldn't say the curse words. So the curse words that are in those lines, he taught him everything else. So then he had to go to a completely different scholar and learn the curse words. So it's like there is a depth of dedication to that I think is absolutely fantastic. Yeah. Plus, you know, Syrian Aramaic ends up for real spoken in. Like, there's a line where Denzel says it's just mumbo jumbo, and John Goodman's like, are you sure about that? And it's funny enough, everyone in the audience is probably thinking it's mumbo jumbo, and are you sure about that? Because it's not. It's legit Syrian Aramaic, which I don't speak. But maybe I can get like one of those, what is it, the Rosetta Stone? Do you think they have Syrian Aramaic?
Think they do. But was the Passion of the Christ in Syrian Aramaic, or was that a different Aramaic?
Oh, God, I know
it's in Aramaic, but I don't know which Aramaic.
I'm not a big fan of snuff films, so I haven't seen that one yet, but
well, hey, there's a junk food cinema we gotta do.
No Easter shows. If we do Easter shows, I would much rather talk about Night of the Lepus.
It's a rated R movie about a guy who comes back from the dead. How the fuck are we not going to cover that?
Bless you. I'd much rather talk about Night of the Lepus if we're going to do an Easter movie. But that being said, God damn it, take another drink. John, going back to John Goodman for a second, of everybody in the film that at some point gets possessed by Azazel, I love John Goodman's turn the most, because throughout most of the movie, as John Goodman is wont to do, he is impossibly likable. Like, he's just such a lovable dude. And when the demon takes over him, his transformation to complete asshat is magnificently diametrically opposite. I love the range, like, probably more so than any other character in the movie that John Goodman is allowed to show, because he's a completely lovable guy one minute, and then gets probably the most screen time next to Elias Koteas as Azazel. So he gets to kind of plumb that depth a little bit more, and I really, really enjoyed what he did with it.
Yeah.
And I think he calls out Denzel Washington. Because one of the triggers, like we said, that, you know, Denzel can recognize that somebody's been possessed as they start singing Time Is On My Side by the Rolling Stones. And John Goodman's character actually starts taunting him and saying, like, are you a Stones fan? No, you probably like the Monkees, don't you, you pussy? And I'm just like, I've never thought of the Monkees as being the rival band to the Stones. I've always heard Stones Beatles. It's the first time I've ever heard Stones Monkees.
So we should probably get into the twist now.
Should we?
We really should, because the twist is really what the point of talking about all this is. Like, we can talk about how great the performances are, and we'll get into other elements like the cinematography and things like that. But really, the core of this movie is one of the best examples of an unreliable narrator ever.
Yeah.
And it is one of those things that when you get to the end of this movie and you find out that the narrator is unreliable, that you have been mostly lied to. You've never actually been lied to. And that was one of the, I did a careful rewatching of it recently, and the narrator never ever really lies, but you're deceived into believing that Denzel Washington, his character, what's the name of his,
Hobbs,
is the person narrating this. And it's not. It's actually the possessed Denzel Washington, Azazel, doing all the narrating.
Yeah.
and explaining what, you know, telling the story from his point of view. But it's told in a way, in such a clever way, that the first time you watch through this, you're like, oh, I'm following along with this. But then on a rewatch, the movie's completely different, because you're watching the story of a fallen angel trying to destroy a man.
Yeah.
And that's what the entire movie is actually about.
The opening line of the film is, I'm going to tell you a story about a time I almost died. And it's in Denzel's voice, and we spend the whole movie knowing that Denzel is the hero of the movie. So we assume what that's telling us is that he will have a happy ending, is that he will not be killed, even though the movie kind of does that Tarantino thing where it starts at the end and then you go back to see how you got there. And then you realize that the voice speaking, even though it sounds like Denzel Washington, is not actually, it's Azazel, and the almost dying is Denzel almost beating him.
Yeah.
So it is sort of the antithesis of a happy ending. I will be honest, I wasn't sure the first time I watched this movie that I was in love with that ending. And I'm still, I don't know, like, I think it makes sense. I think structurally to the story, it totally makes sense. But the lead up to it is handled in a way that feels super gimmicky to me, because throughout the movie, there is this narration. And I remember the first time I watched it, I was like, this narration is so unnecessary. It gets in the way. It's very clunky. And then you realize that without the narration, the twist doesn't work, which is fine, except that it makes me do two things. Since I'm not in love with the twist, I'm just like, why don't you just get rid of the twist and take out the narration? Because either one is kind of, but that being said, Cargill, you and I have had many, many conversations about films that have included the phrase, somewhere there is an edit of this film that. And it's usually when we're talking about a film that we think has a lot of potential, but then, you know, flubs some manner of execution. And what I found out about Fallen is that there is actually a fan edit of this film called Azazel. And what it does is it actually, they remove the narration entirely, and they remove the scenes with the cat, which is kind of the, you know, the signal that Azazel is one, and then they change the song at the end. So basically, they rework it into a film where Azazel doesn't win, which, I don't know, I like the strength of the idea that the demon wins, but the way, like I said, the way it was handled just felt gimmicky to me, and I also don't have a problem with the stones being used. I think that's a great, you know, audio signpost throughout the movie, so I'm not really sure why they got rid of that, but it's just interesting to me that there is an entirely separate edit of this film called Azazel that exists out there. I haven't seen it yet.
I won't watch that edit. That's, that sounds awful. And not an insult onto the person who made their fan edit of the film. But, you know, first of all, the stones are, you know, endemic to this piece. I mean, absolutely. It really was one of those things where the song itself is so important to who Azazel is, you know, and the line that he's singing, you know.
Time is on my side.
Yes, it is.
Yes,
and
it is.
And it has this really sinister, creepy thing of like, look, I'm a fucking angel who has been around since the dawn of time. I'm going to win. No matter what happens, you're going to die and I'm going to win. You know, this is I just got to wait it out. And it's so, I find the twist so important. Because this is a film unlike any other you've ever watched. And in terms of story, it really is truly original in that here is a story about a guy who is bitter and angry and has been on Earth for a long fucking time, and he just can't help but fuck with this guy. And he's like, I'm going to fucking run this guy through the machine. I'm just going to take him through the whole thing. I'm going to fuck with him. I could just kill him. I could just give him one terrible night and fuck with him. But no, I am going to be so arrogant. I'm going to believe in my shit so hard, and I'm going to underestimate this guy so much that I'm going to let him, you know, suffer and suffer and suffer. And then at the end, it fucking comes back to bite him, because as it turns out, Hobbs is fucking sharp and is fucking smarter than Azazel. And Azazel gets lucky.
Yeah.
And Azazel's really lucky at the end, and is lucky on two points. One, that that Hobbs doesn't fully understand the rules, and two, that there's something within a breath of where he is.
Yeah.
And that's the only reason Azazel survives. And there's that sweet release and relief at the end when he's like I said, let me tell you about the time
I almost died.
And it's, you know, and he has that thing. I was beaten. I was broken by Detective John Hobbs. And you're just like, oh, fuck yes. And it's like, this is, and that moment when they reveal it, when they just come out with it, it's great. And when you go back and rewatch the film, all of the narration is about this angel. And it is from his point of view, but all of that dialogue is cleverly written in a way where you believe that it's about it, that it's the other way around. And it's flawlessly executed. And it's such a smart idea. I've seen movies where guys battle demons and guys battle possession. I've never seen one told from the point of view of the possessor until Fallen. And Fallen just does it. It just does it so, you know, in such a fresh way and a wonderful way. And it's so well done, because Denzel really does nail that narration.
See, I completely disagree. I feel like his narration is flat and uninteresting. Like, and that's part of the reason that I just can't get behind it. Like, whether it's Denzel himself or the demon, whoever's talking is annoying the piss out of me, because it just feels like trite film noir runoff that doesn't actually, like, obviously it serves a purpose, but it's so flatly recorded that I'm just like, why are you, stop. The scene is actually really interesting. I wish you would stop talking over it. So I feel like my problem with it ultimately is just that I don't think the voice acting for the narration is particularly interesting. I just find it really flat, which may kind of be my overall problem with the ending, is that it has to be fed by, you know, all of these moments of really just kind of meh narration. But it's like, the payoff is good. I will give you that. The payoff is actually very good. But
and that the way
it's just getting there that I
the
don't
way know. Hobbs beats him is so cool too.
Sure.
You know, it's just that great moment of realization, especially with John Goodman, as you were talking about, being the possessed at that moment. It's just, it's a like, oh, fuck you. Oh, fuck you. And it's so good. And it's so rewarding. I enjoy seeing a story, especially a mainstream story with mainstream fucking actors, you know, a cast that only got better with time, doing a film told from the point of view of the monster.
Yeah. And that, like I said, I agree. I think that's a very strong concept. I just wish that the road to getting there had been a little stronger, but it's interesting. Gregory Hoblit, I'm not sure how you pronounce that, who directed this movie. This was his first film after Primal Fear, which is, of course, one of the great thrillers of the 90s. And then,
great twist thrillers.
Exactly. And then Frequency, which has... it's not really a twist, because you learn it kind of in the middle, I guess, of the second act. But is also kind of based on some kind of really strong, really kind of out there science fiction concept. And so, yeah, I mean, this is a guy who obviously knew what he was doing. He directed, you know, several episodes of NYPD Blue, which is actually where this film takes place. That precinct house is the same. So I thought that was really interesting that, like, his trio of films from 96 to 2000 is Primal Fear, Fallen, and Frequency.
Was Frequency his last film?
No, he also did Heart's War.
Oh.
And then Fracture.
Ah, so his films got more and more forgettable as time went on.
Yes, unfortunately,
because Heart's War isn't bad. I actually kind of like Heart's War. It's a good World War II movie. But yeah, no, the problem is he made a lot of movies that are really solid, but never quite caught, despite having such big name stars at their peaks.
Yeah. Well, it's just, I mean,
Bruce Willis is in Heart's War.
Bruce Willis is in Heart's War.
And along with a fresh and hot and, you know, newly minted...
Colin Farrell. Yeah.
Back when Colin Farrell was everybody's go-to choice.
But
yeah.
You can't make something, you know, as exquisitely delicious as Fallen and then make chicken broth like Heart's War and Fracture. You know, they're just very mediocre films.
I noticed you didn't mention Frequency in there.
I didn't.
You have a nice little soft spot for Frequency.
I do. Yeah.
Like you love the whole dad thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I do. Who doesn't? That movie's fucking
cool. I'm like, why are you grilling me on this? Of course I love Frequency.
I wanted you to feel uncomfortable for a moment. Like, wait, am I not supposed to? I love Frequency. It makes me weep mad tears. What's wrong?
I'm going to stop you right there. When have I ever cared if I'm supposed to like movies?
I'm just saying. You got a little halfway nervous there for a second.
Yeah, because I was like, what? Did somebody from that movie kill somebody? What is going on here? I'm so confused. Yes. But Denzel, I want to go back to Denzel Washington's character for a second. His character's name is Thomas Hobbs.
Tom Hobbs, not John Hobbs.
No, it is John Hobbs, not Thomas Hobbs. Oh. I was wrong. John Hobbs. And actually, I found out that is a portmanteau of two 17th century philosophers.
Yes.
Thomas Locke and Thomas Hobbes. No, John Locke and stop saying Thomas.
Yes.
Thomas Hobbes and John Locke. Thomas Hobbes, of course, came up with the social contract theory. Partially founded on the biblical philosophy of covenants. So you have like a religious connection there. And then John Locke believes that man is inherently good, while Thomas Hobbes believes that man is inherently evil and needs society to kind of keep him in check. So within one character, you have just the name of this character is kind of a hint for the overall conflict of the film. I thought that was kind of interesting, but in a way that is so academically nerdy.
Yeah.
Like, so super nerdy.
I didn't know I knew the Hobbes bit, but the Locke, you know, calling it, you know, John is little, you know, there's kind of an awful lot of philosopher Johns.
True, so. But apparently this is something the writer has said.
Yeah, no, I'm not doubting that. I just didn't know it.
But yeah, no, it's not something you're gonna easily pick up on, because it's like, oh, if you're talking about philosophers named John, obviously you mean John Locke, but... Mm. Yeah, I just thought that was kind of interesting. And then as far as the cinematography goes, now every single movie that we've talked about in this series has had at least one moment that is absolutely inescapably 90s, or one element that it's like, there is no way this movie could exist in any other decade because of this element. And in the case of Fallen, it is the demon vision. Because the demon vision, anytime we see things from Azazel's perspective, the colors are all blown out and it's, you know, very muted and it's very streaky and stuttery. It kind of looks like you're watching the movie through a Pearl Jam video. Like if they had some kind of glasses that allowed you to see the world through a Pearl Jam video, that's what it would look like. And I'm not a huge fan of it. I'm just, I don't know. It feels like one of those, you know, when they had the first handy cams that came out, and it was like one of the in-camera special effects you could do, and then everybody did that for their home videos, and it's like, that's
give,
all.
Give it time. I mean, it's one of those dated things that we, you know, this is what happens in every era. There are those visual cues that happen, and then everyone keys in on them, and then you just see it for a handful of years. In fact, I was just dealing with this
in the 2000s, they chroma keyed in on it.
Oh, yeah. There's you'll find it. There's things that people are doing now that you're like, oh, this is cool, or oh, I'm kind of sick of this. And then 20 years from now, you'll be like, oh yeah, no, back in the 2000s, you know, they wanted big name stars in action movies, but they couldn't fight, so they shot everything really close and edited it really fast. And yeah, we all fucking hated it. But that's what they did. No, I was just dealing with this. Watched a movie with my wife for the first time last week, and we watched Nomads, which is a fantastic film. We should probably talk about one of John McTiernan's first films.
I don't know.
Really, really cool movie. We'll talk about that later.
Take a drink.
But this visual sense that only existed from like 1984 to 1986. Like, it's this very weird, you know, just the lenses they were using and the lighting and their use of fog. It's like so endemically 80s that was, hey, here's this cool new thing. And everybody did it for 5 minutes and everyone's like, oh, fuck, we're sick of that already. And that's what you're talking about. And that's one of the things that having grown up with it being, these are the movies that I was watching in college and post-college, I'm just kind of like, yeah, no, it's, yeah, but, you know, we thought it was cool at the time. It was neat. It was new. It was different. It got old. We stopped doing it. And that was just the way it was.
So, and it's like the lens flare of its time.
Exactly. Yeah. No. And 10 years from now, some J.J. Abrams, young, hot, you know, come upper will start evoking elements of the 90s, and people will be like, oh fuck, I remember when we used to play around with color and overexpose shit for no apparent reason. And it's like, oh yeah, no, we totally, yeah, that was a thing. And but it's, that's what that is, and that is sadly, you know, one of those things that happened, and we'll just kind of move on and let it go, because these elements happen every decade. And this was just, I mean, it was but that was one of the things that was happening. This is, you know, keep in mind that music videos have existed for a long time. You know, everyone likes to pretend that MTV somehow invented the music video, and that was bullshit. MTV wasn't even the first place to show music videos on television. That was Night Flight 3 months before it. Mm-hmm. But what happened was, when music videos became really profitable and they became big industry, all of a sudden these directors who were directing these music videos started getting pulled up and pulled up to the majors, and they brought some of their tricks, their bag of tricks with them. And so that stuff started bleeding into movies.
So the 90s cinematographers will one day be like, clearly I remember shooting at 6 FPS. Yeah. Now people don't give a fuck.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I understand the need for some kind of visual cue that you have changed perspective. I think that's absolutely necessary. But for some reason, everybody was just in love with this. Because it is, like, there's a very brief period of time where it was everywhere. It was in music videos. It was in films. And I don't get it. They use a device called, oh, shit, what was that thing called? An ektachrome. Which is, it was developed for still photography, and then they just found a way to use that, and then, like I said, they shot at 6 frames per second, and it was just like, everybody thought it was amazing looking, and it seems...
Well, that's... I don't know, kind of dull. I wrote a piece years ago about Tony Scott, and how this is the problem with Tony Scott and Tony Scott movies, is that Tony Scott was really experimental, and would just play around with whatever the new toy was, and would try to get new looks, and he'd fuck around with things. And he'd go off and make commercials. Mm-hmm. And he would use those techniques to make commercials, and that's why we do commercials between his movies. Oh, excuse me.
And then the demon entered Cargill.
And then the demon entered Cargill. And then he would play around with those things and master them, and then use them in films. And it's why when you go back and watch Tony Scott films, they almost entirely feel dated. You can almost identify the year it was made just by watching it. Mm-hmm. Because he was the guy pioneering these things, and everybody else would then pick up and go, oh my God, I got to do this in my movie. I got to do this in this music video. And then it would be overdone for 2 or 3 years, and then it would go away because everyone was fucking doing it, and nobody wanted to be a cliche anymore. But he was that guy on the edge. And I feel like, you know, this was one of those things that when that happened in this movie, it was like really fucking cool. When I was watching that in a movie theater in 1997, I was like, oh my God, holy shit, I'm in demon vision. How fucking cool is that?
Filmed in demon vision.
And, you know, watching it again in 2014, I was just kind of like, oh, yeah, somebody would do that shot completely different these days. Just, yeah, we wouldn't be floating over with the warped sides and none of that would happen. No.
We wouldn't try to make it look intentionally like the film was buffering itself. And, you know, it feels like an unused William Castle gimmick though. Like filmed in demon vision, scratch and sniff demons, big cigar chomping in the corner. Yes, this is what the kids will love. It's amazing. There's a weird...
Speaking of John Goodman.
Yeah, right? Hey, Matinee, we should do an episode about... I'll just start drinking myself.
I just watched Matinee again last night.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely fantastic film. There's a weird scene in this movie that the story behind it is... gives it so much even more bizarre content. There's a scene in the movie. There's not jump scares per se in this movie. Except for one. There's one jump scare in this movie... where Denzel Washington, and this is why it feels so out of place, is because it's the only one. Denzel Washington is investigating a basement and a cabin in the woods. Very, you know, typical horror setup. There's a cabin in the woods and he has to go there and he's investigating the basement. And then all of a sudden, like out of nowhere, he's been walking around in this cabin for a long time and there's nothing about it that seems structurally unsound. And yet for some reason he's standing there and the rafters like fall in. And it's just like this real jumpy moment, like, oh, loud noise. And it's like, what? And then he just leaves, and it wasn't because a demon caused it. It wasn't because of a storm that was coming. It was literally just there. And then I find out that that scene not only is not in the original script, it's not in the original cut of the film. They were test screening this movie for audiences, and at one point during the test screening, somebody got up and went to use the bathroom, and when the door shut behind them, it slammed really hard, and people jumped, and the Warner Brothers executives are like, huh. We should put something in this scene that makes people do the thing that they did right there. It's like, you mean jump? Yeah, that's what it's called. You kids and your vocabulary. Yeah, we should put a jump scene in there. And then, so they had to reshoot the scene where he's investigating the basement and just like, I don't know, the fucking ceiling falls. It was Chicken Little? What's going on here? Sure, do that. So that's exactly why that scene exists in the movie. And like I said, why it feels so out of place is that it is the only jump scare in the original movie. So good job, Warner Brothers Suits. Way to get involved. I'm sure that's never happened again, though. That's probably the one instance. Yeah, but you know,
that movie, that scene doesn't really do any... It feels a little out of place, but it doesn't...
No, it doesn't ruin anything.
It doesn't even really distract you much from the movie.
No, it doesn't, but it's... The story behind it is so fucking backwards.
It is classic. It is classic 90s movie making. I mean, it's, you know, the 90s... Keep in mind, the 90s were a really weird time in movies in which nobody really knew... It was one of those things where... audience tastes were changing as we were shifting from generation to generation. And we went from a generation of people that saw movies based upon the names that were in it to a generation that saw movies based upon how good the story was. And that was, we actually, in polling, that's where we saw the flip, was in the 90s, where all of a sudden movie stars were not what got people to go see a movie. It was because they heard it had a good story. And so Hollywood had no idea what they were aiming for, which is why the 90s are so scattershot and experimental. The same thing was happening in music. You know, when grunge killed heavy metal and then grunge itself died, you have this 2-year period where music was just, well, fuck it, we'll play some ska, we'll play some big band, we'll play some rap, we'll play some electronica, we'll throw everything at the wall and see what sticks. And then it's this magic of this really great experimental stuff, which is why we often go back and talk about the 90s. You know, the 80s were so commercial, the 90s were really experimental because the studios had no clue. And it wasn't until about, you know, 2002, 2003, that the studios really got a bead on what audiences wanted again and started making movies for them and were able to follow the trends fairly accurately, which is why you don't see as much experimentation these days as we did in the 90s. But so what you're looking at is the studio going, we have no idea what the audience wants. And then when they, the minute they find what the audience wants, they're like, that, that, Quick, let's do that. Let's shoot an entire new scene. Let's call Denzel Washington fucking back to a set we probably already struck a long time ago,
right,
so we can have a beam fall in and have it be loud. And that is, and that's how movies were made in the 90s.
Yes, thankfully, in this cinematic utopia we live in, studios know exactly what they're doing and never interfere with productions.
Oh, no. Wait a minute, hold on. No, they interfere, but they interfere because they're convinced they know what audiences want, as opposed to just fucking guessing.
You know, Guillermo del Toro, instead of these fishmen, I really think what audiences want to see at the Mountains of Madness are vampires.
That's, okay, that you're mixing your stories, but that is true. It's not Guillermo del Toro that was...
At the Mountains of Madness?
No, because it was... No. The fishmen story that they wanted vampires for was Shadow Over Innsmouth.
Oh, that's right.
Which was going to be by Stuart Gordon. And that's why Stuart Gordon's Shadow Over Innsmouth got canceled, despite spending money on makeup effects and pre-production, because they wanted to change the fishmen to vampire.
But yeah, one other thing I want to talk about really quickly in terms of the production is, you know, we talk about this demon that kind of goes around and causes havoc.
You mean Cyclops' brother?
Yes, yeah. And, you know, this idea that, like, nothing is within our control is actually a running theme throughout the movie. And actually, one of the tenets of Thomas Hobbes was that anarchy is a state of nature. And this movie's production kind of illustrates that in a really bizarre way, because there were a lot of weird things that happened. Like I said, the first scene that they shot was Elias Koteas in the jail. But the first scene that was supposed to be shot was out at that cabin. And it had been raining. There was a rainstorm moving through. So the producers were like, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to get the equipment truck out there now, just in case. And then it'll be there. We don't have to worry about these. There's one road in and out, and it's really slippery. So we're going to get the truck in there before it starts raining. Well, they didn't time it right. It starts pouring down rain. The visibility is so low. The truck actually smacks into a tree and then is blocking the entire road. This is early in the morning. And then it takes them all day to get the truck out. And by the time they get everything there, They've lost the light, so they pretty much have to scrap it. So one day into shooting, they're a day behind shooting, like, which is not a great omen for any film.
No, that's not how you want to start.
And then, so there's this moment, this great, beautiful, emotional moment in the film where, and this is a really ballsy thing that the movie does, the primary relationships in the film are between Denzel Washington and his brother, and then, you know, his brother and his son, and Denzel Washington and his nephew. It's this kind of family, you know, network that they've built. And there's a moment in the film where they actually, I'm actually still kind of shocked that they killed off the brother, who is this kind of almost like LeVar Burton type. I mean, it's not LeVar Burton playing him, but he has that kind of LeVar Burton, nerdy kind of quality to him. And he's a very sweet guy, and they just fucking kill him off. And it was heartbreaking, but even more heartbreaking was the scene where Denzel Washington has to tell the nephew that his dad has died. And they shot that entire scene. They were in love with it. And then, you know, this whole movie, even though it's not stated, was shot in Philadelphia. And they were sending the audio and the video up to a lab in New York to be processed. And on the way there, the courier lost the audio for that scene. Just left it, like, on a bus or on a subway car, like, basically en route to this laboratory. So they're freaking out because at this point, a reshoot is not really possible. They love that scene. They don't want to lose it, but they don't have any audio for it. So they actually took out an ad in the paper, basically offering a reward if anybody finds an audio reel for a movie. And apparently, people did find audio reels. It just wasn't for Fallen, which I think is odd. It's like, how
how many audio reels got lost?
And why do people keep using this courier service that clearly just leaves shit on all the subways? Like, I don't understand that. So they ended up pulling the sound off of the video assist machine.
Yeah.
Which, if you're not familiar with that, it's a tool that allows filmmakers to watch the video version of a take immediately after it happens. And so they took that, and then they blew it up to the right audio quality, and... Because the other thing they didn't want to do, the thing they were really terrified of doing was doing ADR and losing the emotional depth of the scene.
Yeah.
So they had to literally pull it off of the video assist machine. So it kind of seems like throughout different points in the production of this film, like something, like if Chaos Reigns is not just the mantra of Fantastic Fest, it also may be the mantra for the production of Fallen. Because as Thomas Hobbes said, anarchy is a state of nature. And clearly that's what's going on here. But all in all, I think Fallen is one of... I don't know specifically why it doesn't get as much due as it deserves. I don't know, because it has Denzel, it has the cast we talked about. It is in this period, like we said, in the 90s, where you know, people just weren't quite sure what audiences wanted, and I'm not really
this
sure.
This wasn't what audiences wanted at the time. I mean, it's one of those that if you made this movie now, yeah, audiences would be all over. Audiences really embrace the nature of the supernatural and the storytelling. They embrace the idea of unreliable narrators. They, the cast itself is just truly remarkable. But it's one of those movies that at the time, it just didn't hit, and it just didn't connect, and it didn't do well. I remember talking, Scott and I were doing a series of meetings on a project, and while we were talking through it, you know, preparing, I mentioned, Fallen. And Scott's just like, don't mention Fallen. And I'm like, why the fuck wouldn't you mention Fallen? And he's like, because as far as the studios are concerned, Fallen was a failure, and you don't mention Fallen in meetings. Find something else to fill that slot of what you're saying.
Huh.
And it was just like, whoa. And it was really weird for me. But sure enough, you know, in talking to people in the industry, you know, Fallen is not a well-regarded movie, which is why when you brought it up to me, I was like, fuck yes, Fallen. Fallen is, we're going to talk about this because it's been one of my favorites. And in the 90s, it was on my top 10 list of favorite films of all time. I've seen a lot more films now, so it has sadly been removed from that list, but it is up there. I would put it on one of my top 100 favorite films of all time. It's such a good film. It's so well made. It was so fresh and different for its time. Mm-hmm. It took a tact that we had not seen before in telling this story. We still don't see movies very often like this. I mean, so many films have imitated since, but never quite done as well or as reputable as this. This is a film that people can pick up 50 years from now and look at and see as one of those great, you know, Denzel Washington movies. And if you love Denzel, you have no reason to have this as a hole in your filmography, whatever. I'm not going to try to find the right word at this point because I'm just going with it. But then again, if for some reason you've gotten to this point and still haven't seen Fallen, God damn it, we ruined the fucking movie for you.
Totally ruined it.
But at the same time, the thing is the movie really works watching it knowing the twist. Yeah. It's one of those things where my wife hadn't seen it in a long time and completely forgotten the twist. So I was watching her reactions. I watched two movies like that with her recently that she had completely forgotten what the twist of the movie was. And so I was watching her reactions the whole time and watching her get to react to the movie again, not remembering what the movie was really about. And unfortunately, I don't have a brain that lets me do that. I never get to the end of a movie I watched 20 years ago, go, oh, fuck, I totally forgot that he was actually Azazel the whole time. God damn. It's the only thing. This movie we're going to cover in the upcoming month has a twist like that where I'd forgotten everything else about the movie except the twist.
Yeah.
And I remembered the last 5 minutes of the movie and nothing else. And But this is that movie. It is a movie that is just so good. It's so entertaining. And dear God, I mean, to say it one more time, the cast.
Yeah.
You know, it is a bunch of guys at their peak. It is the very end of, it's the end of when we get Donald Sutherland, because Donald Sutherland, as old Donald Sutherland, was really hot there for several years in the 90s. Like, he was the guy that, you know, you've got a big twist in a movie. Donald Sutherland sits on a bench with you out in front of the Capitol building and whispers secrets in your ear. And then you move on with the plot.
It's not at all creepy.
Well, that's what he did for several years. And then, you know, he went into his golden years and shows up every few years doing a cool movie every once in a while. But this was when he was still, you know, at the end of being, you know, really hot again. And then you've got, you know, John Goodman when he's a big, huge star. And you've got Denzel Washington at the start of his career where people are like, oh, I love this new guy, who would then go on to become a Hollywood legend. I loved Virtuosity.
I'm just saying, probably not a lot of people at the time were saying that.
Oh, no, but still, he had appeared in...
No, he had.
Yeah, no, he had done a number of films. He was really that hot, young, you know, sexy black actor that was just... The thing was that he had that thing about him that it was in an era where you didn't have big mainstream African American stars yet, and he was one of those guys that white audiences were like, I love that guy. You know, yeah. I'll watch anything that guy's in. Well, that was a big deal at the time.
He has, and to a certain extent still has. You can still see a glimmer of it even in the older Denzel, but like he had this quality, very much like Tom Cruise, where it was just like the camera can't stop loving that guy.
No, like, not
he,
at all.
Like every moment he's on screen, you just can't stop watching him.
Dude, look at the remake of Taking Pelham 1-2-3, where he put on weight and he was looking very much his age, which is one of the few movies where he let himself do that. The camera still fucking loves that guy. He's got like 50 extra pounds.
Now there's just more of him to love.
There's just more of him for the camera to love, and the camera's just like, "We love you, Denzel."
The camera's like, "I'm gonna add 10 more pounds, and I'm still gonna love you, Denzel Washington.
I'm gonna love you all night long."
All night long. And I think it's funny that you mentioned that Donald Sutherland was in these movies where he whispered a bunch of secrets, like he was always the guy behind the guy. He's literally in a film in 1994 called The Puppet Masters. He is the Puppet Master of the 90s.
Oh, yeah. No. That was the Heinlein adaptation that is not very bueno.
But the point being, Donald Sutherland is the Puppet Master of the 90s. And you should definitely see Fallen. And then you should listen to this podcast. And we'll tell you about a time we almost didn't ruin Fallen.
Beware my wrath.
Which, of course, brings us to the junk food pairing. And this one, I think, works on a few different levels. And see if you can stick with me on it. So, for this week's junk food pairing, I have gone with Domino's Pizza. Because during the course of the film, Jonesy, who is Goodman's character, states with complete certainty, if it wasn't for pizza and other fine Italian foods, there would be no happiness. Jonesy, my man, I tend to agree with you. I specifically went with Domino's, however, because, first of all, they have a little item on their menu called Twisty Bread. And not only that, but the act of setting a line of Domino's and then the way that they topple actually parallels the movement in one really excellent scene in this film, where Azazel is traveling from person to person within seconds. It's just like a chain of light touches that moves Azazel like as he's chasing somebody through people. And actually that scene, funny enough, it's a scene where Azazel's trying to possess Greta. And like I said, like people are just kind of falling into each other and being like possessed up the line. So he is chasing her even though you can't see him. They brought in choreographer Russell Clark, who was hired to block it out, and then they used primarily dancers in that scene to create that flow through effect. Side note, do you know what other film Russell Clark worked on as a choreographer?
No.
That's right, Xanadu!
Yeah.
Hell yes! Absolutely. So think on that if you Xanadu see this film, which you should. Heyo! And that's going to bring us to the end of the episode, and unfortunately the end of Schlocktober. I have had so much fun talking about these horror movies. I fucking love October. I love Halloween.
I am so happy that there's no more fucking puns, for Christ's sake.
Yeah, no.
Oh my God.
No, I'll never make another one, ever.
No, ever. Ever.
You fool! you can find us once again on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, or like us on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema, and please do use those Amazon links. Cargill, where can people find you online?
You can find me at Massawyrm, that's MASSAWYRM, on twitter.com, and you can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/Massawyrm.
Awesome. You can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury. You can also find me on Facebook, facebook.com/BryanSalisburyCritic. And then also I do some podcasting and some blogging over there at oneofus.net, which is kind of my home away from home. We do a lot of great stuff over there. Anything you're into, no matter what your fandom is, we've got something for you. So go check that out. That's oneofus.net. But wrapping up the show for Cargill, this is Brian wishing you a very happy Halloween and reminding you that just because October is ending doesn't mean that the binge horror watching needs cease. After all, guys, time is always on our side.